Jones. I clutched Jamie's arm by reflex. He glanced at me in surprise, then realized what I was looking at and frowned. "Do you hear anything, Sassenach?" he murmured.
"Only the wind."
This had been moaning along with the funeral procession, mostly drowning out the old man chanting the Coronach before the coffin. But as we came out onto the open moor, it picked up speed and rose several tones in pitch, sending cloaks and coats and skirts flapping like ravens' wings. I kept a cautious eye on the stones, but sensed nothing as we drew to a halt before the cairn. It was a passage tomb, of the general kind they called a clava cairn. I had no notion what that signified, but Uncle Lamb had had photographs of many such sites. The passage was meant to orient with some astronomical object on some significant date. I glanced up at the leaden, weeping sky and decided that today was probably not the day anyway.
"We dinna ken who was buried there," Hugh had explained to us the day before, "but clearly a great chieftain of some sort. Must have been the terrible trouble it is to build a cairn like that."
"Aye, to be sure," Jamie had said, adding delicately, "the great chieftain. He's no buried there any more."
"Oh, no," Hugh assured us. "The earth took him long since. There's no but a wee stain of his bones there now. And you needn't be worried about there being a curse upon the place either."
"Oh, good," I murmured, but he paid no attention.
"Some lang nibbit opened the tomb 100 years ago or more, so if there was to be a curse on it, it surely went off attached to him."
This was comforting, and in fact, none of the people now standing about the cairn seemed at all put off or bothered by its proximity. Though it might just be that they had lived near it for so long that it had become no more than a feature of the landscape. There was a certain amount of practical discussion, the men looking at the cairn and shaking their heads dubiously, gesturing in turn toward the open passage that led to the burial chamber, then toward the top of the cairn, where the stones had either been removed or had simply fallen in and been cleared away below. The women gravitated closer together, waiting. We had arrived in a fog of fatigue the day before, and while I'd been introduced to all of them, I had trouble keeping the proper name attached to the proper face. In truth, their faces all looked similar, thin, worn, and pale, with a sense of chronic exhaustion about them, a tiredness much deeper than waking the dead would account for. I had a sudden recollection of Mrs. Bugg's funeral, makeshift and hasty, and yet carried out with dignity and genuine sorrow on the part of the mourners. I thought these people had barely known Simon Fraser. How much better to have regarded his own last wish as stated and left him on the battlefield with his fallen comrades, I thought. But whoever said funerals were for the benefit of the living had had the right of it. The sense of failure and futility that had followed the defeat at Saratoga had made his own officers determined to accomplish something, to make a proper gesture toward a man they had loved and a warrior they honoured. Perhaps they had wanted to send him home too, because of their desire for their own homes. The same sense of failure, plus a deadly streak of romanticism, had doubtless made General Burgoyne insist upon the gesture. I thought he likely felt his own honour required it. And then Hugh Fraser, reduced to a hand-to-mouth existence in the wake of Culloden, and faced with the unexpected homecoming of his younger brother, unable to produce much in the way of a funeral, but deeply romantic himself. And the end of it, this strange procession, bringing Simon Fraser to a home no longer his, and a wife who was a stranger to him. And his place will know him no more. The line came to mind as the men made their decision and began to dismount the coffin from its wheels. I had drawn closer, along with the other women, and found I was now standing within a foot or two of one of the standing stones that ringed the cairn. These were smaller than the stones on Craignadoon, no more than 2 or 3 feet high. Moved by sudden impulse, I reached out and touched it. I hadn't expected anything to happen, and it very luckily didn't, though had I suddenly vanished in the midst of the burial, it would have substantially enlivened the event.
No buzzing, no screaming, no sensation at all. It was just a rock. After all, I thought, there was no reason why all standing stones should be assumed to mark time portals. Presumably the ancient builders had used stones to mark any place of significance. And surely a cairn like this one must have been significant. I wondered what sort of man, or woman perhaps, had lain here, leaving no more than an echo of their bones, so much more fragile than the enduring rocks that sheltered them. The coffin was lowered to the ground, and, with much grunting and puffing, shoved through the passage into the burial chamber in the centre of the tomb. There was a large, flat slab of stone that lay against the cairn, this incised with strange cup-shaped marks, presumably made by the original builders. Four of the stronger men took hold of this and manoeuvred it slowly over the top of the cairn, sealing the hole above the chamber. It fell with a muffled thud that sent a few small rocks rolling down the sides of the cairn. The men came down then, and we all stood rather awkwardly round it, wondering what to do next. There was no priest here. The funeral mass for Simon had been said earlier in a small, bare stone church before the procession to this thoroughly pagan burial. Evidently, Hugh's researches hadn't discovered anything regarding rites for such things. Just when it seemed that we would be obliged simply to turn round and slog our way back to the farmhouse, Ian coughed explosively and stepped forward. The funeral procession was drab in the extreme. None of the bright tartans that had graced Highland ceremonies in the past. Even Jamie's appearance was subdued, cloaked, and his hair covered with a black slouch hat. The sole exception to the general somberness was Ian. He had provoked stares when he'd come downstairs this morning, and the staring hadn't stopped. With good reason. He'd shaved most of his head and greased the remaining strip of hair into a stiff ridge down the middle of his scalp, to which he had attached a dangling ornament of turkey feathers with a pierced silver sixpence. He was wearing a cloak, but under it had put on his worn buckskins with the blue and white wampum armlet his wife Emily had made for him. Jamie had looked him slowly up and down when he appeared, and nodded, one corner of his mouth turning up.
"It will no make a difference, eh?"
he said quietly to Ian as we headed for the door.
"They'll still ken you for who you are."
"Will they?"
Ian had said, but then ducked out into the downpour without waiting for an answer. Jamie had undoubtedly been right. The Indian finery was a dress rehearsal in preparation for his arrival at Lallybroch. For we were bound there directly once Simon's body was decently disposed of, and the farewell whisky had been drunk. It had its uses now, though. Ian slowly removed his cloak and handed it to Jamie, then walked to the entrance of the passage and turned to face the mourners, who watched this apparition bug-eyed. He spread his hands, palms upward, closed his eyes, put back his head so the rain ran down his face, and began to chant something in Mohawk. He was no singer, and his voice was so hoarse from his cold that many words broke or disappeared, but I caught Simon's name in the beginning. The General's Death Song. It didn't go on for long, but when he dropped his hands, the congregation uttered a deep, collective sigh. Ian walked away, not looking back, and without a word the mourners followed. It was finished. Chapter 76. By the Wind Grieved. The weather continued to be terrible, with fitful gusts of snow now added to the rain, and Hugh pressed us to stay at least for another few days, until the sky should clear.
"It might well be Michaelmas before that happens," Jamie said to him, smiling. "Nay, cousin, we'll be off."
And so we were, bundled in all the clothes we possessed. It took more than 2 days to reach Lallybroch, and we were obliged to shelter overnight in an abandoned croft,
putting the horses in the cow byre next to us. There was no furniture, nor peat for the hearth, and half the roof had gone, but the stone walls broke the wind.
"I miss my dog,"
Ian grumbled, huddling under his cloak and pulling a blanket over his goose-pimpled head.
"Would he sit on your head?"
Jamie inquired, taking a firmer hold on me as the wind roared past our shelter and threatened to rip away the rest of the threadbare thatch overhead.
"You should have thought about it being January before you shaved your scalp." "Well enough for you," Ian replied, peering balefully out from under his blanket. "You've got Auntie Claire to keep warm with."
"Well, you might get a wife yourself one of these days. Is Rollo going to sleep with the both of you when you do?" Jamie inquired.
"Mm-hmm,"
Ian said, and pulled the blanket down over his face, shivering. I shiver too, in spite of Jamie's warmth. Our combined cloaks, 3 woolen petticoats, and 2 pairs of stockings. I had been in a number of cold places in my life, but there's something remarkably penetrating about the Scottish cold. In spite of my longing for a warm fire and the remembered cosiness of Lallybroch, though, I was almost as uneasy about our approaching homecoming as Ian was. And Ian had been growing more like a cat on hot bricks the farther we got into the Highlands. He twitched and muttered to himself now, thrashing in his blankets in the darkened confines of the shed. I had wondered when we landed in Edinburgh whether we ought to send word of our arrival to Lallybroch. When I'd suggested this, though, Jamie laughed.
"Do you think we stand the slightest chance of getting within 10 miles of the place without everyone hearing of it?"
"Never fear, Sassenach," he'd assured me. "The minute we set foot in the Highlands, everyone from Loch Lomond to Inverness will know that Jamie Fraser's coming home with his English witch, and a red Indian with him to boot."
"English witch?" I said, not sure whether to be entertained or offended. "Did they call me that when we were at Lallybroch?"
"Frequently to your face, Sassenach," he said dryly. "But you didn't have enough Gaelic then to know it."
"They didn't mean it as an insult, Ian," he added more gently. "Nor will they now.
It's only that Highlanders call a thing as they see it."
"Hmm," I said, a trifle taken back.
"They'll no be wrong now, will they?"
he asked, grinning. "Are you implying that I look like a witch?"
"Well, not so much just this minute," he said, narrowing one eye judiciously. "First thing in the morning, maybe. Aye, that's a more fearsome prospect."
I hadn't a looking-glass, not having thought to acquire one in Edinburgh. I did still have a comb, though, and snuggling now with my head beneath Jamie's chin, resolved to stop some way short of Lallybroch and employ it thoroughly, rain or no rain. Not, I thought, that it would likely make much difference whether I arrived looking like the Queen of England or like a dandelion gone to seed. It was Ian's homecoming that was important. On the other hand, I wasn't sure quite what my own welcome might be. There was unfinished business, to put it mildly, between myself and Jenny Murray. We had been good friends once. I hoped we might be again. But she had been the chief engineer of Jamie's marriage to Lyra Mackenzie, from the best of motives, no doubt. She'd worried for him, lonely and rootless on his return from captivity in England, and, in all justice, she'd thought me dead. What had she thought, I wondered, when I'd suddenly appeared again? That I had abandoned Jamie before Culloden and then had second thoughts? There hadn't been time for explanations and rapprochement, and there had been that very awkward moment when Lyra, summoned by Jenny, had showed up at Lallybroch, accompanied by her daughters, taking Jamie and me very much by surprise. A bubble of laughter rose in my chest at thought of that encounter, though I certainly hadn't laughed at the time. Well, perhaps there would be time to talk now, once Jenny and Ian had recovered from the shock of their youngest son's homecoming. I became aware, from subtle shiftings behind me, that while the horses were breathing heavily and peacefully in their byre, and Ian had finally subsided into phlegm-rattling snores, I wasn't the only one still lying awake thinking of what might await us.
"You aren't asleep either, are you?"
I whispered to Jamie.
No,
he said softly, and shifted his weight again, gathering me more closely against him.
Thinking about the last time he came home. I had such fear, and a very wee bit of hope. I imagine it's maybe like that for the lad now.
And for you now? I asked, folding my own hands over the arm that encircled me, feeling the solid, graceful bones of wrist and forearm, gently touching his maimed right hand. He sighed deeply.
Dinner, Ken, he said. But it'll be all right. You're with me this time.
The wind dropped sometime in the night, and the day, by some miracle, dawned clear and bright. Still cold as a polar bear's bottom, but not raining. I thought that a good omen. Nobody spoke as we cleared the last high pass that led to Lallybroch and saw the house below. I felt a loosening in my chest and only then realized how long I'd been holding my breath. It hasn't changed, has it? I said, my breath white on the cold air.
There's a new roof on the dovecot, Ian said, and Mam's sheep pen is bigger.
He was doing his best to sound nonchalant, but there was no mistaking the eagerness in his voice. He nudged his horse and pulled a little in front of us, the turkey feathers in his hair lifting on the breeze. It was early afternoon, and the place was quiet. The morning chores had been done, the evening milking and supper making not yet started. I didn't see anyone outside, save a couple of big, shaggy Highland cattle munching hay in the near pasture. But the chimneys were smoking, and the big, white-harled farmhouse had its usual hospitable, settled air. Would Bree and Roger ever go back here? I wondered suddenly. She'd mentioned it, when the notion of their leaving became fact, and they had begun to plan. It's vacant, she'd said, eyes fixed on the 20th-century style shirt she was making, for sale. Or it was when Roger went there a few years ago. She looked up with a wry smile. It wasn't really possible to discuss time in any customary way. I'd like the kids to live there, maybe, but we'll just have to see how things work out. She'd glanced then at Mandy, asleep in her cradle, faintly blue around the lips. It will work out fine, I'd said firmly. Everything will be just fine. Lord, I prayed now, silently, that they might be safe. Ian had swung off his horse and was waiting impatiently for us. As we dismounted, he headed for the door, but our arrival had been noted, and it swung wide before he could touch it. Jenny stopped dead in the doorway. She blinked, once, and her head tilted slowly back as her eyes travelled up the long, buckskin-covered body with its roped muscles and small scars, to the crested, feathered head with its tattooed face, so carefully expressionless. Save for the eyes, whose hope and fear he couldn't hide, mohawk or no. Jenny's mouth twitched. Once, twice. Then her face broke, and she began to utter small, hysterical whoops that turned into unmistakable laughter. She gulped, whooped again, and laughed so hard that she staggered backward into the house and had to sit down on the bench in the hall, where she bent double with her arms wrapped round her middle and laughed until the sound gave out and her breath came in faint, wheezing gasps. "Ian," she said at last, shaking her head. "Oh, God, Ian! My wee lad!" Ian looked entirely taken aback. He looked at Jamie, who shrugged, his own mouth twitching, then back at his mother. She gulped for air, her chest heaving, then stood up, went to him, and wrapped her arms about him, her tear-streaked face pressed to his side. His arms went slowly, carefully around her, and he held her to him like something fragile, of immense value. "Ian," she said again, and I saw her small, taut shoulders suddenly slump. "Oh, Ian, thank God you've come in time." She was smaller than I had remembered, and thinner, her hair with a little more grey in it, though still darkly vibrant. But the deep blue cat eyes were just the same, as was the natural air of command she shared with her brother. "Leave the horses," she said briskly, wiping her eyes on the corner of her apron. "I'll have one of the lads take care of them. You'll be frozen and starving. Take off your things and come into the parlour." She glanced at me, with a brief look of curiosity and something else that I couldn't interpret, but didn't meet my eyes directly or say more than, "Come," as she led the way to the parlour. The house smelt familiar, but strange, steeped in peat smoke and the scent of cooking. Someone had just baked bread, and the yeasty smell floated down the hall from the kitchen. The hall itself was nearly as cold as the outdoors. All the rooms had their doors closed tight to keep in the heat from their fires, and a welcome wave of warmth eddied out when she opened the door to the parlour, turning to pull Ian in first. "Ian," she said, in a tone I'd never heard her use before. "Ian, they've come. Your son's come home." Ian the elder was sitting in a large armchair close to the fire, a warm rug over his legs. He struggled to his feet at once, a little unsteady on the wooden peg he wore in replacement of a leg lost in battle, and took a few steps toward us.
"Ian," Jamie said, his voice soft with shock. "God, Ian."
"Oh, aye," Ian said, his own voice wry. "Dinna fash. It's still me."
Phthisis, they called it. Or doctors did. It meant wasting in the Greek. Laymen called it by the blunter name, consumption. And the reason why was all too apparent. It consumed its victims, ate them alive. A wasting disease, and waste it did. Ate flesh and squandered life, profligate and cannibal. I'd seen it many times in England of the 30s and 40s, much more here in the past. But I'd never seen it carve the living flesh from the bones of someone I loved, and my heart went to water and drained from my chest. Ian had always been whipcord thin, even in times of plenty. Sinewy and tough, his bones always near the surface of his skin, just as young Ian's were. Now.
"I may cough, but I won't break," he assured Jamie,
and stepping forward, put his arms round Jamie's neck. Jamie enfolded him very gently, the gingerness of the embrace growing firmer as he found that Ian didn't break, and closed his eyes to keep the tears in check. His arms tightened, trying involuntarily to keep Ian from the abyss that all too plainly yawned at his feet. "I can count all my bones." The biblical quote came unbidden to my mind. I quite literally could. The cloth of his shirt lay over ribs that showed so clearly that I could see the articulations where each one joined the protruding knobs of his backbone. "How long?" I blurted, turning to Jenny, who was watching the men, her own eyes bright with unshed tears. "How long has he had it?" She blinked once and swallowed.
"Years," she said, steadily enough. "He came back from the toll booth in Edinburgh with the cough, and it never left. It's got worse over the last year, though."
I nodded. A chronic case, then. That was something. The acute form, galloping consumption, they called it, would have taken him in months. She gave me back the question I had asked her, but with a different meaning. "How long?" she said, so softly that I barely heard her. "I don't know," I said, with equal softness, "but not long." She nodded. She had known this for a long time.
"Just as well you came in time, then," she said, matter of fact.
Young Ian's eyes had been fixed on his father from the moment we entered the room. The shock showed plainly on his face, but he kept himself in hand.
"Duh," he said,
and his voice was so hoarse that the word emerged in a strangled croak. He cleared it viciously and repeated, Da, coming forward. The elder Ian looked at his son, and his face lit with a joy so profound that it eclipsed the marks of illness and suffering.
Oh, Ian, he said, holding out his arms. My wee lad.
It was the Highlands, and it was Ian and Jenny, which meant that matters that might have been avoided out of confusion or delicacy were instead addressed forthrightly.
I may die tomorrow, or not for a year, Ian said frankly over jam, bread and tea, hastily magicked out of the kitchen to sustain the weary travellers until supper should be ready. I'm betting on 3 months myself. 5-2 if anyone fancies a wager. Though I dinna ken how I'll collect my winnings.
He grinned, the old Ian showing suddenly through his death's head face. There was a murmur of something not quite laughter among the adults. There were a great many people crammed into the parlour, for the announcement that had brought forth bread and jam had also caused every inhabitant of Lallybroch to come boiling out of its rooms and recesses, thundering down the stairs in their anxiety to greet and reclaim their prodigal. Young Ian had nearly been knocked flat and trampled by his family's affection, and this, coming on the heels of the shock of seeing his father, had stunned him into muteness, though he kept smiling, quite helpless in the face of 1,000 questions and exclamations. Jenny had rescued him at last from the maelstrom, taking him by the hand and pushing him firmly into the parlour with the elder Ian, then popping back out herself to quell the riot with a flashing eye and a firm word before ushering the rest of them in an orderly fashion. Young Jamie, Ian and Jenny's eldest and Jamie's namesake, now lived at Lallybroch with his wife and children, as did his sister Maggie and her 2 children, her husband being a soldier. Young Jamie was out on the estate, but the women came to sit with me. All of the children were clustered round young Ian, staring and asking so many questions that they collided with one another and pushed and shoved, arguing as to who asked what and who should be answered first. The children had paid no attention to the elder Ian's remark. They already knew Grandad was dying, and the fact was of no interest by comparison with the fact of their fascinating new uncle. A tiny girl, with her hair in stubby plaits, sat in young Ian's lap, tracing the lines of his tattoos with her fingers, now and then sticking one inadvertently in his mouth as he smiled and made hesitant answers to his inquisitive nieces and nephews.
"You could have written," Jamie said to Jenny, with an edge of reproach in his voice. "I did," she said, with her own edge, "a year ago, when his flesh began to melt away, and we kent it was more than a cough. I asked you to send young Ian then, if you could."
"Ah," Jamie said, discomforted. "We must have left the ridge before it came. But did I not write last April to tell you we were coming? I sent the letter from New Bern."
"If you did, I never got it. Nay wonder with the blockade. We see no more than half what we used to that sent from America. And if you left last March, it's been a long voyage, no?"
"A bit longer than I expected, aye," Jamie said dryly. "Things happened along the way."
"So I see."
Without the least hesitation, she picked up his right hand and examined the scar and the close-set fingers with interest. She glanced at me, one eyebrow quirked, and I nodded.
"He was wounded at Saratoga," I said, feeling oddly defensive. "I had to." "It's a good job," she said, gently flexing his fingers. "Does it pain you much, Jamie?"
"It aches in the cold. Nay bother otherwise, though."
"Whisky," she exclaimed, sitting bolt upright. "Here you are, frozen to the bone, and I've not thought... Robbie, run and fetch down the special bottle from the shelf above the coppers."
A gangling boy who had been hovering on the edge of the crowd round young Ian gave his grandmother a reluctant glance, but then, catching the depth charge of her eye, shot out of the room to do her bidding. The room was more than warm, with a peat fire simmering on the hearth and so many people talking, laughing, and exuding body heat. It was on the verge of tropical. But there was a deep chill around my heart whenever I looked at Ian. He lay back in his chair now, still smiling, but exhaustion was evident in the slump of his bony shoulders, the droop of his eyelids, the clear effort it took to keep smiling. I looked away and found Jenny looking at me. She glanced away at once, but I had seen speculation in her eyes, and doubt. Yes, we'd have to talk. They slept warm that first night, tired to the point of collapse, close together and enfolded by Lallybroch. But Jamie heard the wind on the edge of waking. It had come back in the night, a cold moan around the eaves of the house. He sat up in bed, in the dark, hands wrapped around his knees, listening. The storm would be coming. He could hear snow in the wind. Claire laid beside him, half curled in sleep, her hair a dark smudge across the white pillow. He listened to her breathe, thanking God for the sound, feeling guilt at the soft, unhindered flow of it. He'd been hearing Ian's cough all evening, and had gone to sleep with the sound of that laboured breathing in his mind, if not his ears. He'd managed, from sheer exhaustion, to put aside the matter of Ian's illness, but it was there with the waking, heavy as a stone in his chest. Claire shifted in her sleep, turning half onto her back, and desire for her welled up in him like water. He hesitated, aching for Ian, guilty for what Ian had already lost, and he still had, reluctant to wake her. "I feel maybe like you did," he whispered to her, too low to wake her, "when you came through the stones. Like the world is still there, but it's no the world you had." He'd swear she hadn't wakened, but a hand came out from the sheets groping, and he took it. She sighed, long and sleep-laden, and pulled him down beside her, took him in her arms, and cradled him, warm on her soft breasts. "You're the world I have," she murmured, and then her breathing changed, and she took him down with her into safety. Chapter 77. Memorari. They'd been eating breakfast in the kitchen, just the two Ians, for his father had waked coughing before dawn, and fallen back into such a deep sleep afterward that his mother hadn't wanted to waken him, and he himself had been hunting over the hills with his brother and nephews all night. They had stopped on the way back at Kitty's house, and young Jamie had declared they would stay to eat and sleep a bit, but Ian had been restless, wanting to come home, though he couldn't have said why. "Perhaps for this," he thought, watching his father shake salt over his porridge in the same way he'd seen him do it for 15 years before he left Scotland. He'd never once thought of it in all his time away, but now that he saw it again, it was as though he'd never left, as though he'd spent every morning of his life here at this table watching his father eat porridge. He was possessed of a sudden desire to memorize this moment, to know and to sense every last thing about it, from the worn, smooth wood under his elbows to the stained granite of the countertop, and the way the light fell through the tattered curtains at the window, lighting the bulge of muscle at the corner of his father's jaw as he chewed a bit of sausage. The elder Ian glanced up suddenly, as though feeling his son's eyes on him.
"Shall we go out on the moor?" he said. "I've a fancy to see if the red deer are calving yet."
He was surprised at his father's strength. They walked for several miles, talking of nothing and everything. He knew it was so they could grow easy with each other again and say the things that had to be said, but he dreaded the saying. They stopped at last, far up on a high stretch of moorland where they could see the roll of the great smooth mountains and a few wee lochs glittering like fish under a pale, high sun. They found a saint's spring, a tiny pool with an ancient stone cross, and drank from the water, saying the prayer of respect for the saint, and then sat down to rest a little way beyond.
"It was a place like this where I died the first time,"
his father said casually, running a wet hand over his sweating face. He looked rosy and healthy, though so thin. That bothered young Ian, knowing he was dying, yet seeing him like this.
"Aye," he said. "When was that, then?"
"Oh, in France, when I lost my leg."
The elder Ian glanced down at his wooden peg, indifferent.
"One minute I was standing up to fire my musket, and the next I was lying on my back. I didn't even ken I'd been hit. You'd think you'd notice being hit by a 6-pound iron ball, wouldn't you?"
His father grinned at him, and he smiled grudgingly back.
"I would. Surely you thought something must have happened, though?" "Oh, aye, I did. And after a moment or two, it came back to me that I must have been shot. But I couldn't feel any pain at all."
"Well, that was good," young Ian said encouragingly.
"I kent then I was dying, aye?"
His father's eyes were on him, but looked beyond him at that far-off battlefield.
"I wasn't really bothered, though. And I wasn't alone."
His gaze focused then on his son, and he smiled a little. Reaching out, he took hold of Ian's hand, his own wasted to the bone, the joints of it swollen and knobbled, but the span of his grasp still as big as his son's.
"Ian,"
he said, and paused, his eyes crinkling.
"Do you ken how odd it is to say someone's name when it's yours as well?" "Ian," he repeated more gently. "Dunna fash. I wasn't afraid then. I'm not afraid now." "I am," Ian thought, but he couldn't say that. "Tell me about the dog," his father said then, smiling.
And so he told his father about Rollo, about the sea battle where he thought Rollo drowned or dead, how it had all come about that they'd gone to Ticonderoga and been at the terrible battles of Saratoga. And told him, without thinking about it, for thinking would have frozen the words in his throat, about Emily, about Isabel, and about the swiftest of lizards.
"Haven't you told anyone else about that?" he said, suddenly shy. "About the wee lad, I mean."
His father breathed deep, looking happy. Then coughed, whipped out a handkerchief and coughed some more, but eventually stopped. Ian tried not to look at the handkerchief in case it should be stained with blood.
"You should,"
the elder Ian croaked, then cleared his throat and spat into the handkerchief with a muffled grunt.
"You should tell your mother," he said, his voice clear again. "She'd be happy to ken you've got a son, no matter the circumstances." "Aye, well, maybe I will."
It was early for bugs, but the moor birds were out, poking about, taking flight past their heads and calling out in alarm. He listened to the sounds of home for a bit and then said,
"Da, I've got to tell you something bad."
And sitting by a saint's pool in the peace of the early spring day, Ian told him what had happened to Merdina Bug. His father listened with a grave attention, head bowed. Young Ian could see the heavy streaks of grey in his hair and found the sight both moving and paradoxically comforting.
"At least he's lived a good life," he thought. "But maybe Mrs. Bug did too. Would I feel worse about it if she'd been a young girl?"
He thought he would, but he felt badly enough as it was. A little better for the telling, though. The elder Ian rocked back on his haunches, arms clasped about his good knee, thinking.
"It wasn't your fault, of course," he said, with a sidelong look at his son. "Do you ken that? In your heart?"
"No," Ian admitted, "but I'm trying."
His father smiled at that, but then grew grave again.
"You'll manage. If you've lived with it this long, you'll be all right in the end. This matter of old Arch Bugnow. He must be as old as the hills if he's the same one I kent. A taxman for Malcolm Grant, he was.
That's the man. I keep thinking that he's old. He'll die. But what if he dies and I dinna ken he's dead?
He made a gesture of frustration.
I dinna want to kill the man. But how can I not, and him wandering about, set to do harm to Rick? To my... Well, if I should ever have a wife.
He was floundering, and his father put a stop to it, grasping his arm.
Who is she? He asked, interest bright in his face. Tell me about her.
And so he told about Rachel. He was surprised that there was so much to tell, in fact, considering that he'd known her only a few weeks and kissed her just the once. His father sighed.
He sighed all the time. It was the only way he got enough breath.
But this one was a sigh of happiness.
Ah, Ian, he said fondly. I'm happy for you. I canna say how happy. It's what your mother and I have prayed for these many years, that you'd have a good woman to love, and a family by her. Well, it's too soon to be thinking of my family, young Ian pointed out, considering she's a Quaker and likely won't wed me, and considering I'm in Scotland and she's with the Continental Army in America, probably being shot or infected with plague right this minute.
He'd meant it seriously, and was somewhat offended when his father laughed. But then the elder Ian leaned forward and said with utter seriousness,
You needn't wait for me to die. You need to go and find your young woman.
I canna.
Aye, you can. Young Jamie's got Lallybroch. The girls are well wed. And Michael.
He grinned at the thought of Michael.
Michael will do well enough, I think. A man needs a wife. And a good one is the greatest gift God has for a man. I'd go much easier, Avalach, if I kent you were well fettled in that way.
Aye, well,
young Ian murmured,
maybe so, but I'll not go just yet.
Chapter 78 Old Debts. Jamie swallowed the last bite of porridge and took a deep breath, laying down his spoon.
Jenny?
Of course there's more, she said, reaching for his bowl. Then she caught sight of his face and stopped, eyes narrowing.
Or is that not what you had need of?
I wouldn't say it's a need precisely, but...
He glanced up at the ceiling to avoid her gaze and commended his soul to God.
What do you ken of Lyra Mackenzie?
He risked a quick glance at his sister, and saw that her eyes had gone round, bright with interest.
Lyra, is it?
She sat back down and began to tap her fingers thoughtfully on the tabletop. Her hands were good for her age, he thought, work-worn, but the fingers still slim and lively.
She's not wed, Jenny said, but you'll ken that, I imagine.
He nodded shortly.
What is it you want to know about her?
Well, how she fares, I suppose, and...
And who's sharing her bed?
He gave his sister a look.
You're a lewd woman, Janet Murray.
Why? Well, a war wi' you then, and ask the cat.
Blue eyes just like his own glittered at him for an instant, and the dimple showed in her cheek. He knew that look, and yielded with what grace was possible.
Do you know?
No,
she said promptly. He raised one brow in disbelief.
Why? Pull the other one.
She shook her head and ran a finger around the edge of the honey jar, wiping off a golden bead.
I swear on St. Futhad's toenails.
He hadn't heard that one since he was 10 and laughed out loud despite the situation.
Well, then, no more to be said, is there?
He leaned back in his chair, affecting indifference. She made a small huffing noise, got up, and began busily to clear the table. He watched her with narrowed eyes, not sure whether she was messing him about only for the sake of mischief, in which she'd yield in a moment, or whether there was something more to it.
"Why is it you want to know?"
she asked suddenly, eyes on the stack of sticky balls.
That brought him up short.
I didn't say I did want to know, he pointed out, but since you mentioned it, anyone would be curious, no?
They would, she agreed.
She straightened up and looked at him, a long, searching sort of look that made him wonder whether he'd washed behind his ears.
I don't know, she said at last, and that's the truth.
I only heard from her that once that I wrote you. Aye, and just why did you write me about it, he wondered, but didn't say so out loud. Mm-hmm, he said, and you expect me to believe that you left it there?
He remembered it, standing here in his old room at Lallybroch, the one he'd had as a boy, on the morning of his wedding to Lyra. He'd had a new shirt for the occasion. There wasn't much money for much beyond the barest essentials, and sometimes not that. But Jenny had contrived him a shirt. He suspected she'd sacrificed the best of her two shifts for it. He remembered shaving in the reflection in his washbasin, seeing the gaunt, stern face of a stranger emerge beneath his razor, thinking that he must remember to smile when he met Lyra. He didn't want to frighten her, and what he saw in the water was enough to frighten him. He thought suddenly of sharing her bed. He resolutely put aside the thought of Claire's body. He'd had a great deal of practice in that, which caused him instead to think suddenly that it had been years, aye, years. He'd lain with a woman only twice in the last 15 years, and it was 5, 6, maybe 7 years since the last time. He'd suffered a moment's panic at the thought that he might find himself unable, and touched his member gingerly through his kilt, only to find that it had already begun to stiffen at the mere thought of bedding. He drew a deep breath, somewhat relieved. One less thing to worry over, then. A brief sound from the door jerked his head round to see Jenny standing there, wearing an unreadable expression. He coughed and took his hand off his cock.
"You haven't got to do it, Jamie," she said quietly, eyes fixed on his. "If you've thought better of it, tell me."
He'd nearly done it. But he could hear the house. There was a sense of bustle in it, a purpose and a happiness it had lacked for a very long time. It wasn't only his own happiness at stake here. It never had been.
"No," he'd said abruptly, "I'm fine."
And smiled reassuringly at her. As he went downstairs to meet Ian at the foot, though, he heard the rain on the windows and felt a sudden sense of drowning, an unwelcome recollection of his first wedding day, and how they'd held each other up, he and Claire, both bleeding, both terrified.
"All right, then," Ian had said to him, leaning in, low-voiced. "Aye, fine," he replied, and was pleased at how calm his voice was.
Jenny's face appeared briefly round the door to the parlour. She looked worried but relaxed when she saw him.
"It's all right, Munian," Ian had assured her, grinning. "I've got a grip on him in case he takes it into his head to bolt."
Ian was, in fact, gripping his arm rather to Jamie's surprise, but he didn't protest.
"Well, drag him in, then," his sister had said, very dry. "The priest's come."
He'd gone in with Ian, taken up his place beside Lyra in front of old Father McCarthy. She'd glanced up at him briefly, then away. Was she frightened? Her hand was cool in his, but didn't shake. He squeezed her fingers gently, and she turned her head, looking up at him then, directly. No, not fright, and not candle glow or starshine. There was gratitude in her gaze, and trust. That trust had entered his heart, a small, soft weight that steadied him, restored at least a few of the severed roots that had held him to his place. He'd been grateful too. He turned at the sound of footsteps now, and saw Claire coming along the hall. He smiled, noting that he'd done so without the slightest thought, and she came to him, taking his hand as she peered into the room.
"Yours, wasn't it? When you were young, I mean.
I thought Jenny told me so. When we came here the first time, I mean."
Her mouth twisted a little. She and Jenny did speak now, of course, but it was a stilted kind of speaking, both of them over-careful, shy of saying too much or the wrong thing.
Aye, well, he was afraid of saying too much or the wrong thing himself, but damned if he'd be a woman about it.
"I need to go and see Lyra," he said abruptly.
"Will you kill me if I do?"
She looked surprised, and then, damn her, amused. "Are you asking my permission?"
"I am not," he said, feeling stiff and awkward. "I only... well, I thought I should tell you, is all."
"Very considerate of you." She was still smiling, but the smile had taken on a certain wariness. "Would you care to tell me why you want to go and see her?"
"I didn't say I want to see her," he said, a noticeable edge in his voice. "I said I need to."
"Would it be presumptuous of me to ask why you need to see her?" Her eyes were just that bit wider and yellower than usual. He'd roused the hawk in her. He hadn't meant to at all, but he wavered for an instant, suddenly wanting to seek refuge from his own confusion in an almighty row. But he couldn't, in conscience, do that. Still less could he explain the memory of Lyra's face on their wedding day, the look of trust in her eyes, and the nagging feeling that he had betrayed that trust.
"You can ask me anything, Sassenach. And you have," he added pointedly. "I'd answer if I thought I could make sense."
She made a small sniffing noise, not quite, but he took her meaning clear enough.
"If you only want to know who she's sleeping with, there are probably less direct ways of finding out," she said.
Her voice was carefully level, but her pupils had dilated.
"I don't care who she's sleeping with."
"Oh, yes, you do," she said promptly.
"I don't."
"Liar, liar, pants on fire," she said,
and on the verge of an explosion, he burst out laughing instead. She looked momentarily taken back, but then joined him, snorting with it and her nose going pink. They stopped in seconds, abashed at being hilarious in a house that hadn't known open laughter for too long, but were still smiling at each other.
"Come here," he said softly,
and held out a hand to her. She took it at once, her fingers warm and strong on his, and came to put her arms around him. Her hair smelled different. Still fresh and full of the scent of live green things, but different. Like the Highlands. Like Heather, maybe.
"You do want to know who it is, you know," she said, her voice warm and tickling through the fabric of his shirt. "Do you want me to tell you why?"
"Aye, I do, and no, I don't," he said, tightening his hold. "I ken well enough why, and I'm sure you and Jenny and every other woman in 50 miles thinks they do too. But that's not why I need to see her."
She pushed a little way back then, and brushed the falling curls out of her eyes to look up at him. She searched his face thoughtfully and nodded.
"Well, do give her my very best regards then, won't you?"
"Why, you vengeful wee creature, I'd never have thought it of you."
"Wouldn't you indeed," she said, dry as toast. He smiled down at her and ran a thumb gently down the side of her cheek.
"No," he said, "I wouldn't. You're no one to hold a grudge, Sassenach. You never have been."
"Well, I'm not a Scot," she observed, smoothing back her hair. "It's not a matter of national pride, I mean." She put a hand on his chest before he could answer and said quite seriously, "She never made you laugh, did she?"
"I may have smiled once or twice," he said gravely, "but no."
"Well, just you remember that," she said, and with a swish of skirts was off. He grinned like a fool and followed her. When he reached the stairs, she was waiting, halfway down. "One thing," she said, lifting a finger at him.
"Aye."
"If you find out who she's sleeping with and don't tell me, I will kill you." Balriggan was a small place, little more than 10 acres, plus the house and outbuildings. Still, it was bonny. A large grey stone cottage tucked into the curve of a hill, a bitty wee loch glimmering like a looking glass at its foot.
The English had burned the fields and the barn during the rising, but fields came back, much more easily than the men who tilled them. He rode slowly past the loch, thinking that this visit was a mistake. It was possible to leave things behind, places, people, memories, at least for a time. But places held tight to the things that had happened in them, and to come again to a place you had once lived was to be brought face to face with what you had done there and who you had been. Balriggan, though, it hadn't been a bad place. He had loved the wee loch and the way it mirrored the sky, so still some mornings that you felt you might walk down into the clouds you saw reflected there, feeling their cold mist rise up about you to wrap you in their drifting peace. Or in the summer evenings, when the surface glimmered in hundreds of overlapping rings as the hatch rose, the rhythm of it broken now and then by the sudden splash of a leaping salmon. The road took him closer, and he saw the stony shallows where he'd shown Wee Joan and Massali how to guddle fish, all three of them so intent on their business they'd paid no heed to the midges biting, and gone home wet to the waist and red with bites and sunburn, the wee maid skipping and swinging from his hands, gleeful in the sunset. He smiled just a little, then turned his horse's head away, up the hill to the house. The place was shabby, but in decent repair, he grudgingly noted. There was a saddle mule browsing in the paddock behind the house, elderly but sound-looking. Well enough. Lyra wasn't spending his money on follies, or a coach and four at least. He set his hand on the gate and felt a twist go through his weam. The feel of the wood under his hand was eerily familiar. He'd lifted it without thinking at the spot where it was always inclined to drag on the path. That twist corkscrewed its way up to his mouth as he recalled his last meeting with Ned Gowan, Lyra's lawyer. "What does the bloody woman want, then?" he demanded, exasperated. To which Ned had replied cheerfully, "Your head mounted above her gate." With a brief snort, he went through, closing the gate a bit harder than necessary, and glanced up at the house. Movement took his eye. A man was sitting on the bench outside the cottage, staring at him over a broken bit of harness on his knee. "An ill-favoured wee lad," Jamie thought, scrawny and narrow-faced as a ferret, with a wall eye and a mouth that hung open as though in astonishment. Still, Jamie greeted the man pleasantly, asking was his mistress to home the day. The lad, seen closer too, he must be in his 30s, blinked at him, then turned his head to bring his good eye to bear. "Who are you, then?" he asked, sounding unfriendly.
"Fraser of Broch Tuarach," Jamie replied.
It was a formal occasion, after all.
"Is Mrs.?"
He hesitated, not knowing how to refer to Lyra. His sister had said she persisted in calling herself Mrs. Fraser, despite the scandal. He hadn't felt he could object, the fault of it being his and he being in America in any case. But damned if he'd call her that himself, even to her servant.
"Fetch your mistress, if you please," he said shortly.
"What do you want with her?"
The straight eye narrowed in suspicion. He hadn't expected obstruction, and was inclined to reply sharply, but reined himself in. The man clearly kent something of him, and it was as well if Lyra's servant was concerned for her welfare, even if the man's manner was crude.
"I wish to speak with her, if you've no great objection," he said with extreme politeness. "Do you think you might make shift to go and tell her so?"
The man made a rude sound in his throat, but put aside the harness and stood up. Too late, Jamie saw that his spine was badly twisted and one leg shorter than the other. There was no way to apologise that wouldn't make matters worse, though, and so he only nodded shortly and let the man lurch his way off into the house, thinking that it was just like Lyra to keep a lame servant for the express purpose of embarrassing him. Then he shook himself in irritation, ashamed of his thought. What was it about him that a hapless woman such as Lyra Mackenzie should bring out every wicked, shameful trait he possessed? Not that his sister couldn't do it too, he reflected ruefully.
but Jenny would evoke some bit of bad temper or hasty language from him, fan the flames till he was roaring, and then extinguish him neatly with a word, as though she'd doused him with cold water.
"Go see her," Jenny had said.
"All right, then," he said belligerently. "I'm here."
"I see that," said a light, dry voice. "Why?" He swung round to face Lyra, who was standing in the doorway, broom in hand, giving him a cool look. He snatched off his hat and bowed to her.
"Good day to you. I hope I see ye well the day."
Apparently so. Her face was slightly flushed beneath a starched white kerch, blue eyes clear. She looked him over, expressionless save for fair brows arched high.
"I heard you were come home. Why are you here?"
"To see how you fare."
Her brows rose that wee bit higher.
"Well enough. What do you want?"
He'd gone through it in his mind 100 times, but should have known that for the waste of effort it was. There were things that could be planned for, but none of them involved women.
"I've come to say sorry to you," he said bluntly. "I said it before, and you shot me.
Do you want to listen this time?" The brows came down. She glanced from him to the broom in her hand as though estimating its usefulness as a weapon, then looked back at him and shrugged.
"Suit yourself. Will you come in then?"
She jerked her head toward the house.
"It's a fine day. Shall we walk in the garden?"
He had no wish to enter the house with its memories of tears and silences. She regarded him for a moment or two, then nodded and turned toward the garden path, leaving him to follow if he would. He noticed that she kept a grip on the broom, though, and wasn't sure whether to be amused or offended. They walked in silence through the kale yard and through a gate into the garden. It was a kitchen garden, made for utility, but it had a small orchard at the end of it, and there were flowers growing between the pea vines and onion beds. She'd always liked flowers. He remembered that with a small twist of the heart. She'd put the broom over her shoulder, like a soldier carrying a rifle, and strolled beside him, in no hurry, but not offering him an opening either. He cleared his throat.
"I said I'd come to apologize."
"So you did."
She didn't turn to look at him, but stopped and poked her toe at a curling potato vine.
"When we wed," he said,
trying to retrieve the careful speech he'd thought of,
"I should not have asked you. My heart was cold. I'd no right to offer you a dead thing."
Her nostrils flared briefly, but she didn't look up, just went on frowning at the potato vine as though she suspected it might have bugs.
"I knew that," she said at last. "I did hope..."
She broke off, lips pressing tight as she swallowed.
"I did hope I might be of help to you, though. Everyone could see you needed a woman. Just not me, I suppose," she added bitterly.
Stung, he said the first thing that came to his tongue.
"I thought you needed me."
She looked up then, her eyes gone bright. Christ, she was going to weep, he knew it. But she didn't.
"I'd wains to feed."
Her voice was hard and flat and hit him like a slap on the cheek.
"So you did," he said, keeping his temper.
It was honest, at least.
"They've grown now, though."
And he'd found dowries for both Massali and Joan, too, but he didn't suppose he'd be given any credit for that.
"So that's it," she said, her voice growing colder. "You think you can talk your way out of paying me now? Is that it?"
"No, that's not it, for God's sake."
"Because," she said, ignoring his denial and swinging round to face him, bright-eyed, "you can't. You shamed me before the whole parish, Jamie Fraser, luring me into a sinful match with you, and then betraying me, laughing at me behind your hand with your sassana whore."
"I didna."
"And now you come back from America, fardled up like an English popinjay."
Her lip curled in scorn at his good ruffled shirt, which he'd worn to show her respect, God damn it.
"Flaunting your wealth
and playing the great yin with your ancient hussy, foaming in her silks and satins on your arm, is it? Well, I'll tell you.
She swung the broom down from her shoulder and drove the handle of it violently into the ground.
You dinna understand one thing about me, and you think you can awe me into crawling away like a dying dog and troubling you no more? Think again, that's all I'll say to you. Just think again.
He snatched the purse out of his pocket and flung it at the door of the garden shed, where it struck with a boom and bounced off. He had just a moment to regret having brought a chunk of gold, and not coins that would jingle, before his temper flared.
Aye, you're right about that, at least. I dinna understand one thing about you. I never have, try as I might.
Oh, try as you might, is it? She cried, ignoring the purse. You never tried for an instant, Jamie Fraser. In fact...
Her face clenched up like a fist as she fought to keep her voice under control.
You never truly looked at me. Never.
Well, no, I suppose you looked once, when I was 16.
Her voice trembled on the word and she looked away, jaw clamped tight. Then she looked back at him, eyes bright and tearless.
You took a beating for me, at Leoch. Do you recall that?
For an instant he didn't. Then he stopped, breathing heavily. His hand went instinctively to his jaw, and against his will he felt the ghost of a smile rise against the anger.
Oh, aye, I do.
Angus Moore had given him an easier time than he might have, but it was a fair beating nonetheless. His ribs had ached for days. She nodded, watching him. Her cheeks were splotched with red, but she'd calmed herself.
I thought you'd done it because you loved me. I went on thinking that, Ken, until well after we'd wed. But I was wrong, wasn't I?
Bafflement must have shown on his face, for she made that small in her nose that meant she was aggravated. He knew her well enough to know that, at least.
You pitied me, she said flatly. I didna see that then. You pitied me at Leoch, not only later when you took me to wife. I thought you loved me, she repeated, spacing the words as though speaking to a simpleton. When Dougal made you wed the Sassenach whore, I thought I'd die. But I thought maybe you felt like dying too. And it wasna like that at all, was it?
No, he said, feeling awkward and foolish.
He'd seen nothing of her feelings then, hadn't seen a thing but Claire. But of course, Lyra had thought he loved her. She was 16. And would have known that his marriage to Claire was a forced one, never realizing that he was willing. Of course she'd thought she and he were star-crossed lovers. Except that he'd never looked at her again. He rubbed a hand over his face, feeling complete helplessness.
You never told me that, he said finally, letting his hand drop.
What good would it have done? She said.
So there it was. She'd known. She must have known, by the time he married her, what the truth of it was. But still, she must have hoped. Unable to find anything to say in reply, his mind took refuge in the irrelevant.
Who was it? He asked.
Who?
Her brow furrowed in puzzlement.
The lad. Your father wanted you punished for wantonness, no? Who did you play the loon with then, when I took the beating for you? I never thought to ask.
The red splotches on her cheeks grew deeper.
No, you never would you?
A barbed silence of accusation fell between them. He hadn't asked then.
He hadn't cared. I'm sorry, he said softly at last. Tell me, though, who was it?
He hadn't cared then in the least, but found himself curious now, if only as a way of not thinking of other things, or not saying them. They hadn't had the past she'd thought, but the past lay still between them, forming a tenuous connection. Her lips thinned, and he thought she wouldn't say, but then they parted, reluctant. John Robert MacLeod. He frowned, at a loss for a moment, and then the name dropped into its proper place in memory and he stared at her.
John Robert? What, him from Killiecrankie?
Aye, she said, him.
Her mouth snapped shut on the word. He hadn't known the man well at all, but John Robert MacLeod's reputation among young women had been the subject of a good deal of talk among the men-at-arms at Leoch in his brief time there. A sly, good-looking slink of a man, handsome and lean-jawed, and the fact that he'd a wife and wains at home in Killiecrankie seemed to hamper him not at all.
Jesus, he said, unable to stop himself. You're lucky you kept your maidenhead.
An ugly flush washed darkly over her from stays to cap, and his jaw dropped.
Lyra Mackenzie, you weren't such a wanton fool to let him take your virgin to his bed.
I didn't ken he was married, she cried, stamping her foot. And it was after you wed the Sassenach. I went to him for comfort.
Oh, and he gave it you, I'm sure.
Hush your gob, she shrieked,
and picking up a stone watering pot from the bench by the shed, hurled it at his head. He hadn't expected that. Claire threw things at him frequently, but Lyra never had, and was nearly brained. It struck him in the shoulder as he ducked aside. The watering pot was followed by a hail of other objects from the bench, and a storm of incoherent language, all manner of unwomanly swearing, punctuated by shrieks like a tea kettle. A pan of buttermilk hurtled toward him, missed its aim, but soaked him from chest to knees with curds and whey. He was half laughing, from shock, when she suddenly seized a mattock from the shed wall and made for him. Seriously alarmed, he ducked and grabbed her wrist, twisting so she dropped the heavy tool with a thump. She let out a screech like a banshee and whipped her other hand across his face, half blinding him with her nails. He snatched that wrist too and pressed her back into the wall of the shed, her still kicking at his shins, struggling and writhing against him like a snake.
I'm sorry,
he was shouting in her ear to be heard above the noise she was making.
Sorry. Do you hear me? I'm sorry.
The Clish MacLaver stopped him hearing anything behind, though, and he hadn't the slightest warning when something monstrous struck him behind the ear and sent him staggering, lights flashing in his head. He kept his grip on her wrists as he stumbled and fell, dragging her down atop him. He wrapped his arms tight round her to keep her from clawing him again and blinked, trying to clear his watering eyes.
Free her, MacGiffin!
The mattock chunked into the earth beside his head. He flung himself over, Lyra still clutched to him, rolling madly through the beds. The sound of panting and uneven steps, and the mattock came down again, pinning his sleeve to the ground and scraping the flesh of his arm. He jerked free, heedless of tearing skin and cloth, rolled away from Lyra, and sprang to his feet, then launched himself without pause at the wizened figure of Lyra's servant, who was in the act of raising the mattock above his head, narrow face contorted with effort. He butted the man in the face with a crunch and bore him flat, punching him in the belly before they hit the ground. He scrambled atop the man and went on punching him, the violence some relief. The man was grunting, whimpering and gurgling, and he'd drawn back his knee to give the bugger one in the balls to settle the matter when he became dimly aware of Lyra screeching and beating at his head.
Leave him alone,
she was shrieking, crying and slapping at him with her hands.
Leave him! Leave him, for the love of bride! Don't hurt him!
He stopped then, panting, feeling suddenly a terrible fool. Beating a scrawny cripple who meant only to protect his mistress from obvious attack? Manhandling a woman like a street ruffian?
Christ, what was the matter with him?
He slid off the man, repressing an impulse to apologise, and got awkwardly to his feet, meaning to give the poor bugger a hand up at least. Before he could manage, though, Lyra fell to her knees beside the man, weeping and grappling at him, finally getting him partway sitting, his narrow head pressed to her soft round bosom. She, heedless of the blood gushing from his smashed nose, petting and stroking him, murmuring his name. Joey, it seemed to be. Jamie stood swaying a bit, staring at this demonstration. Blood was dripping from his fingers, and his arm was beginning to burn where the mattock had skinned it. He felt something stinging run into his eyes, and, wiping it away, found that his forehead was bleeding. Joey, the open-mouthed, had evidently inadvertently bitten him when he'd butted the man. He grimaced with disgust, feeling the tooth marks in his forehead, and groped for a handkerchief with which to staunch the blood. Meanwhile, foggy as his head felt, matters on the ground in front of him were becoming clearer by the moment. A good mistress might try to comfort a wounded servant, but he'd yet to hear a woman call a servant Mochia, let alone kiss him passionately on the mouth, getting her own face smeared with blood and snot in the process. "Mm-hmm," he said. Startled, Lyra turned a blood-smeared, tear-stained face to him. She'd never looked lovelier.
"Him," Jamie said incredulously, nodding toward the crumpled Joey. "Why, for God's sake?"
Lyra glared at him, slit-eyed, crouched like a cat about to spring. She considered him for a moment, then slowly straightened her back, gathering Joey's head once more against her breast.
"Because he needs me," she said evenly. "And you, you bastard, never did."
He left the horse to graze along the edge of the loch, and stripping off his clothes, walked into the water. The sky was overcast, and the loch was full of clouds. The rocky bottom fell away, and he let the grey, cold water take him, his legs trailing loose behind, his small injuries chilling into numbness. He put his face under the water, eyes closed, to wash the cut on his head, and felt the bubbles of his breath soft and tickling over his shoulders. He raised his head and began to swim slowly, with no thought at all. He lay on his back among the clouds, hair afloat like kelp, and stared up into the sky. A spatter of rain dimpled the water around him, then thickened. It was a soft rain, though. No feel of the drops striking him, only a sense of the loch and its clouds bathing his face, his body, washing away the blood and fret of the last little while. Would he ever come back? He wondered. The water filled his ears with its own rush, and he was comforted by the realization that, in fact, he had never left. He turned at last and struck out for the shore, cutting smooth through the water. It was still raining, harder now, the drops a constant tapping on his bare shoulders as he swam. Still, the sinking sun shone under the clouds and lit Balriggan and its hill with a gentle glow. He felt the bottom rise and put his feet down, then stood for a moment, waist deep, looking at it for a bit. "No," he said softly, and felt remorse soften into regret. And at last, the absolution of resignation.
"You're right. I never did. I'm sorry."
He walked out of the water then, and with a whistle to the horse, pulled the wet plaid over his shoulders, and turned his face toward